This is Pastor Michael's Book Club on Restless. Let's get to it.
We should do it.
Romantic Roots. Hey, how do you pronounce? Is it Descartes? Is it
Descartes?
Descartes.
I don't. My assumption is that that's not actually quite the exact right French pronunciation, but that's how I've always heard it pronounced. That's how I've always pronounced it. Is Descartes.
I will, in humility, admit to you that I, when I first read through this book, was calling him Descartes until Elise heard me say that. And,
and she is literate.
She is literate. She has read a book and is also French. And so she was very quick to correct me. Wait, what did you just say?
Too funny.
Mm-hmm.
Is she French? Does she have?
Yeah, her mom is actually from Canada. She's French Canadian.
No way.
Yeah. So my wedding suit coat has the Canadian flag on the inside.
Does it?
Like, yeah. Because they didn't have an American flag. So I'm just kidding.
Until we conquer them.
Right. Yeah, until we imperialize.
We decide
Canada.
To conquer them. Yeah. Not saying it's going to be hard. I'm
right.
just saying
yeah.
until we make the decision.
The whole time they're just saying sorry.
Sorry. All right. Not the French Canadians, actually.
No.
Those guys are pretty intense, crazy people.
Yeah.
Yes. All right, so let's get into it. Yeah, so what Truman does in this chapter is talks about some of the philosophical underpinnings of the things that had to happen in order for something like, say, transgenderism or any of these ideas to really take root.
Mm-hmm.
And to do that, he goes back to both Descartes and to Rousseau and talks through some of the ideas that stemmed from them and how we got where we are. But, you know, he points out this is, you know, right on the first page of the chapter,
mm-hmm.
he just puts the contrast like this of, you know, kind of where we're at. He says, the sentence, "I am a woman trapped in a man's body," would have been nonsense to my grandfather. Had it been uttered by a patient to a doctor in the mid-20th century, the doctor would almost certainly have responded that the patient had a psychiatric problem, that his mind needed to be treated so as to bring its feelings into line with his physical body. Today, the doctor is more likely to respond that the problem is such that the patient's body needs to be brought into alignment with those inner feelings. Indeed, were a doctor to respond in the earlier fashion today, he might well find himself subject to legal action. What has changed in our society and in the social imaginary to bring this new situation about? That just puts it in such a stark contrast. I mean, even when you read, like, you know, the idea of a doctor trying to tell somebody, no, your feelings need to be brought in line with your physical body. It sounds nice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It just sounds like, wow, that would be awesome if people did that.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously he's right. That's not the case right now, by and large.
Yeah, which is crazy. Well, it's kind of, I'm glad he like has this chapter too. Well, really that's the whole book is like going back and trying to see what philosophical ideas brought about this cultural moment.
Mm-hmm.
And because I think for us, he said mid-20th century, I would even say probably 20, 30 years ago, you know, like towards the turn of the century, like it would still be like, oh yeah, if someone went to a doctor and was like, I'm a woman trapped in a man's body, he'd be like, you're insane. Here's some like, you know, I'm going to admit you to the war.
I'm not an old guy. Yeah. In some ways I might be. But I'm not a very old man.
Mm-hmm.
I remember a time when like this was pretty crazy.
Yeah.
When even homosexuality was kind of like a, you know, it was still somewhat fringe. It was like, you know, kind of accepted, mm-hmm. but it's still a little bit out there. Versus where we're at today with, you know,
government
the whole
flying the flag. You know, it's like,
flying the flag and making it the number one priority that we continue to, you know, push through the education system, entertainment, whatever, the continued acceptance of all kinds of variant sexualities, all kinds of, you know, what you might call deviant sexualities.
Yeah.
And so that's, but like I remember, I remember when that was not as prominent. It was there, right? Like the propaganda was there, the movement was there already, but it was, I mean, you know, I mean, I lived majority of, maybe not a majority of, but a large portion of my life Now I'm trying to do the math and find out if it is a majority, maybe a majority of my life before Obergefell, before the very idea of, you know, gay marriage was even a, it was like maybe a weird thing that one state decided to do once.
Yeah, that was like, oh, that's California's out there.
Yeah, it's thing. Crazy. It's weird. It's different.
Right.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, it's, but the thing is, I think to us, it looks like it came on so fast. And in a way, it kind of did. But Truman here really shows that's like, no, this stuff doesn't just like happen like this. It's a long line of ideas that have been like slowly and slowly more accepted by society that contribute to this.
Right.
So it's,
yeah, you have to. This it's interesting is that, especially for a lot of people today, maybe some people that even listen to this, because you've just grown up in a system that's just assumed these things.
Yeah.
It's taught them, assumed them. Everything is based upon some of these philosophical presuppositions that Truman's going to talk about. You don't even realize that there was something else, that there could be something else.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right? Again, it's that social imaginary piece where not only do you have the ability in your social imaginary now to think these things are valid, but you actually have lost the part of a social imaginary that would say, hey, there's actually another option even. No, there's no other option. So he says, he's focusing specifically on what he calls the granting of decisive authority to inner feelings.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of the like the major shift that he says took place, and why he's going to go to some of these figures and their philosophical pursuits that led to that. But that idea, like when I just read that phrase, I think a lot of people would be like, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Wait, what do you mean that's different or a problem or...
Why are you challenging that?
Or something just that is like a new phenomenon in human history.
Right.
Like that's... You wouldn't think that at all. You'd be like, no, that's just...
Well, the way it's taught, it's always been that way.
Yeah. Of course, right? Think about how often the very idea of, you know, believing in yourself, looking into your heart, you know, what's in your heart, like all those sorts of things being, this is what you need to live a good life, to be who you're supposed to be, and everybody else has to accept that. That's the norm. That's everything. You know, that's how we all live.
Yeah. Right. And that's been around longer, a lot longer than, again, the more brash outworking of the LGBTQ movement. Like, I mean, my little girl is, like, into Disney movies. It's like, you watch, like, princess movies from, like, the 1950s. It's like, well, you still get a lot of that, you know, oh, my dream, my heart, like, what's in the heart, and all that stuff. So that's been around a lot longer.
Yep.
But you just see how it's like, oh, actually, that idea
is just
a trajectory of, like, you know, makes you think a couple, you know, makes you take a second thought about it.
Well, we always watch them. I always catechize my kids while we watch.
Yeah, it's a good
like idea. The character will say something like that, and I'll say, "You think that's a good idea?
Yeah.
Do you think that's What do you think? Is that right?
Yeah.
Should you follow your heart? Does your heart know everything?
Yeah.
I turn every movie that my kids ever watch into a story about why you should trust your dad. Yeah. Everyone. Every single one of them is just about why dad is right.
Yeah. Yes.
That's great.
Yes.
When are you going to show him X-Men, the homosexual propaganda film? No, transgender.
Right.
I think on page 32, he makes this statement, you know, we should note that this... Again, this movement to, like, you know, the inner self is authoritative, or the transgender movement, all that stuff, is not a scientific movement. It's the result of, it's not a result of following the science. The science can study the body and the mind and can describe and analyze how the two connect, but how the relationship between the two is constructed in terms of what has normative authority rests upon evaluative judgment shaped by a wider philosophical or cultural commitments. The question for us, therefore, is where do these commitments originate?
Because that's your.
Right? So it's not as if, oh, we've looked at the data, we've analyzed it objectively, and it's like, we were wrong about this. Like, it's a scientific study of, like, oh, yeah, we were, like, our scientific theories were wrong about, you know, maleness and femaleness and all that stuff. It's purely philosophical in nature. Like you said, the social imaginary has shifted to, like, place the authority more so on people's inner feelings than what is objective and observable reality.
Yeah, he then, in the next paragraph, yields a little bit of, like, yeah, emotions are really important, and this idea of inner feelings, like, we can look at Augustine for this, or we can look at the Psalms for this, or
Greek tragedy. Just kidding. Just
kidding. He kind of summarizes his thought, though, on that. He says, simply acknowledging this inner dimension of human selfhood is not the same thing as authorizing it to have a decisive role in identity. So you don't have to grant it the decisive authority. You don't have to do that to inner feelings in order to acknowledge that inner feelings are legitimate and real and have importance.
Yeah.
But yeah, there can be a difference.
So yeah. Yeah. And I think the point he makes too, and if you read the Confessions and you read the Psalms, right, it's always, here's my inner feelings, and then I weigh them against, to the objective outward standard of God and His Word. Right. That's the point. Was like, this is how I'm feeling. This is what I was doing. Like, I'm reading through the Psalms right now.
Psalm 42, I think it was.
Yeah, that's really what it is. It's like, I feel this way, Lord. I'm like, I'm downtrodden. I'm downcast. Like, why are you hiding your face from me? And then it's really all of them. And turning to God, like realizing He's still on the throne.
Like shepherding, redirecting your own emotions.
Exactly. Like, He recognizes what His emotions are, and then He realizes who God. Like, then He recognizes who God is, and then brings His feelings and His thoughts and emotions in line with God.
Like the doctor who tells the patient, "Okay, let's get your mind fixed. Instead of trying to fix your body to your mind, as a female attracted to male's body, let's fix your mind." Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, let's realign with what is actually true.
Yep.
But to have that, you actually have to believe in some kind of
objective.
Exactly.
So that that brings us to the first of these characters that Truman introduces, and that is René Descartes. And so it's like
Descartes.
Not
Descartes. There.
Yes, he was a man, even though his name's René. The French, the French.
Yeah.
You never know with the French.
That's
where all this transgender stuff came from.
Oh, man. Actually, I'm just going to admit something for everybody to know. I actually do really like the French in a lot of ways.
Dang it.
Especially once you get into farming, especially like small homestead type farming, you learn that a lot of the practices that are best and a lot of the best breeds for small farms, but also high quality as far as different animals go, man, a lot of it comes from the French. But not from the French that we know that are probably like the city French. It's like the countryside French. I like the countryside French.
Which of those two people did the fries come from? Who's responsible for that?
It's great. Freedom fries. You're talking about freedom fries?
Freedom fries.
Anyway, we have René Descartes, who lived from 1596 to 1650. And a lot of people have heard of Descartes because of his axiom, I think, therefore I am. And this is N.D. Wilson, and I think it's in Notes from the Tilt-A-Whirl, talks about René Descartes as the little engine that could, and he says, I think I am. like he's just like pushing himself into existence.
Exactly.
Because actually, when you think about the very idea, which maybe we should talk about what that idea is first, and then I'll come to my critique. And Truman comes to his critique, I guess, too. But basically, the idea, as we have it coming down to us, is that Descartes was looking for some kind of objective something to base everything else on, right? Some kind of objective starting place for all rationality and laws and everything that the human mind thinks of. And there was some confusion in his day, especially because of the Reformation and the kind of questioning of what seemed to have been long-standing ideas about where truth comes from and how reality works. that were in, like, some of them were false, right? Some of them were true, but some of them were false. And they had kind of worked their way into the psyche of most people. It was just the way things were. And then you have somebody that comes and they question that, they change that, and it just destabilizes things a little bit. And so Descartes is looking for some kind of stability. He's looking for something that will be solid ground. And what he comes down to is he starts to just doubt everything. Like, what can he question? What can he doubt? And he gets down to, well, what I can't doubt is that I am thinking, right? Like, I myself am thinking and rationalizing and thinking through things. So, therefore, I know that I am because I'm thinking. Now, I actually think you can doubt that, right? There's plenty of people that do. You can keep going, actually. When you start with a radical skepticism and just start trying to doubt everything, actually, you can doubt everything. Not that that makes it right, right? I think it's foolish and silly. I think there's plenty of reasons not to, but you can keep going down that road. And we see a lot of, you know, problems stemming from that. But what Truman says, falling down on page 33 near the bottom, is, what is of interest to my narrative is the way this places human thought, a psychological phenomenon, at the very center of the project. Thinking is the ground of certainty. So everything comes down to something that is internal, in other words, that is psychological, that's happening inside of you. That's the only thing you can't doubt. You can doubt everything else, but you can't doubt that. And then you kind of work your way out. So it just shifts everything. The medieval mind was a mind that was very little focused on what is inside of me. Right? Very little focused on what am I thinking, what am I feeling, and much more focused on objective outside things. Some of it not necessarily being actual objective truth, right, in terms of certain long-held views within the church that were aberrant, that had, you know, erred in various ways, but were just accepted as fact. Certain things that, you know, the medieval church taught that were not right. But even just looking out at, you know, the heavens and the movement of the planets and the seasons and the changing of weather and you know, the fact that most people are still doing some kind of physical work, physical trade, something like that, where not everything was in your head. In fact, almost nothing was. It was almost all outside, physical, tangible, something around you and outside of you, as opposed to inside of you. And so Descartes comes along, and that actually shifts everything. You know, that really shifts everything to that internal focus.
Yeah, he kind of closes the book on Descartes. I'm going to say that really confidently, so that way I sound like I believe what I'm saying. The French clearly don't know how to spell.
Hear that, wipe? You're like, hear that? I know how to say words.
What up now, elite? Anyway, close saying this. We might say, from the vantage point of current developments, that Descartes formulated the notions of mind and body in a way that gave fundamental importance to the former and potentially set the two in opposition. Though it was not Descartes' intention to do so, establishing this psychological foundation for certainty set in place a conceptual framework that makes transgenderism plausible. Which, you gotta wonder, if you were to present modernity to Descartes today, what his response would be. Like, oh yeah, of course, that's the natural outworkings of my philosophy.
Almost definitely be horrified.
Almost, right, almost certainly not.
Man, ideas have consequences, right? Ideas have consequences that are much more far-reaching than even we realize. We don't realize how dangerous words and ideas really are. Now, they're also good and right and life-giving, and they build and create, but it is, I mean, it's a dangerous task to set out to be a philosopher, right? A man of thoughts and words and living a life that, you know, expresses some kind of metaphysic or something like that. Like, that is, it's a dangerous business. And not many should do it. Right? Scripture says not many should.
Everything you just said is in James 3. Yeah. Everything, like, all of that. the dangers of the tongue.
It's funny to me because so many people don't think that. Like they think like, oh, you're not working with concrete objects, like, so you really can't hurt somebody. It's like, are you kidding me?
Like, this is way more dangerous.
This is way more dangerous because, like you said, ideas have consequences. Ideas become action. Any action that has taken place, good or bad, in the world has originated with a thought, with an idea, with words, and then been taken action. Like it, you have to understand that's how things work. People don't just act without thinking about it, without having ideas and words in their head that correspond to that action. It all originates with ideas.
We're recording this right now, right? This podcast. Exactly. Us talking right now. This is dangerous business, you know? Like, we should really count the cost of what we're doing because it's, I mean, it is.
We're responsible for what
it's serious work. Yeah, we're responsible. I sent Matt a meme once. It was a guy who, you know, gets up to the pearly gates of heaven and he's talking to St. Peter outside. And he says, you know, St. Peter, did I live a good life? Did I do anything wrong? And maybe he says something to Peter like, you know, did I waste my life? Was my life wasted? And Peter says, no, you're a podcaster. You wasted millions of lives or something like that, right? Like, you wasted thousands of
lives.
Not
only your own life, but everyone else's life.
That's hilarious. Yeah.
It's brutal, right? Like, that is, you know, you want it to be helpful, but you know, it's something to be aware of. Yeah. Even thinking, you know, what could the long-term consequences be?
Yeah.
Right? Think about how many things in my life have completely shifted, like the trajectory of my life has shifted by reading like one sentence in a book or hearing one line on, you know, in a debate or in a, like, you know, listening to a podcast or something.
Yep.
And it's just shifted everything.
Right.
Yep. That's the danger of well, words.
Yeah, and when John in John 1 talks about Jesus being the Word, like that, I think that just shows us the significance and the power of words, is that the Word is God Himself, the Son of God Himself, that spoke, and God spoke the earth, creation to existence. His words literally created everything.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so that just, I think that just goes to show us the power of words, both, you know, bad words to do evil things and good words to bring good.
Yeah.
Right, because that's what we do. Like, that's how we reach the world. That's how the church changes the world, is through the power of the gospel and preaching.
Well, I preach the gospel, always use words when necessary.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. So you're supposed to just do all this social activism stuff and then not say anything.
Right.
And people and know, people understand the divinity.
Take advantage of that.
Yeah.
And
that doesn't sound like it. What?
They gladly just go on their own.
Use you to destroy society and culture.
It's like, the gospel by osmosis doesn't work.
Oh, man.
Oh, boy.
Well, I could get away with not knowing Descartes and how to pronounce his name, but the next philosopher that Truman brings up, I had no confusion about how to pronounce his name, because Rousseau, as Truman notes, is, I feel like, far better known and a little more influential on our culture.
Yeah, it's a much more straight line, too.
Mm-hmm.
When you read anything from Rousseau, you begin to see a lot more. Like, it looks more similar, right? When Descartes says, I think, therefore I am, it's like, well, I don't know what you're getting at. when you think about it for a while, when you get into it, you can see the connection. But you are correct that Jean Rousseau...
Jean-Jacques
Rousseau.
Rousseau.
That he has had a much bigger impact.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's almost frightening thinking about how Rousseau really. I mean, he comes from Geneva. This, you know, Calvin's Geneva. This is only a short time. We're looking at a little over 100 years later. And so you realize the destabilizing effect of the Reformation. Now, it's necessary and right. You know, obviously, I'm Presbyterian. I love John Calvin. I love the Reformation. I'm not going to dog on it at all. And I don't think that it's easy because the Reformation came along to look back and say, well, that's what really changed things. But a lot of these things were going to happen. almost no matter what. They were going to happen because it's just part of the progression of peoples and modern society. But it's fine for us to recognize that, no, actually, because people's faith and religious understanding is the centerpiece of everything. When that is destabilized in some form, it's going to have, you know, really, really potentially dangerous consequences, even if necessary.
Yeah.
Right. It's, you know, it's not unlike when you think about a really invasive surgical procedure. Always comes with risks, right? If you cut somebody open and remove something, there's always risk involved.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes it has to be done, right? Sometimes it's necessary.
Yeah.
And so that's how I would, you know, that's kind of where things were at least in on a societal level, I would argue, right? On a, like a social level.
Mm-hmm.
And so anyway, Rousseau comes along, you know, he says, this is just in that first paragraph still. He says his thought was also an inspiration for both the French Revolution and the artistic movement now known as Romanticism, which he's going to develop a little bit more with in Romanticism.
Mm-hmm.
There's, you know, he points out stuff like, you know, Rousseau is known for he had children with different women, right? He kind of lived a very free life. All of those kids he would just send right to an orphanage, didn't care for them at all. They almost definitely did die early, Truman says, because of the nature of an orphanage at that time. Like, we got to realize, like, this was a really corrupt and wicked guy. And so that it's easy to disconnect those things, and most people will, right? Most times if you read like a book about philosophers, it's going to say, here's their ideas. But you got to think about the man that it comes from, because we actually disagree with Rousseau that, you know, that, you know, what is outside in a sense doesn't actually, you know, matter as much as what's inside. Actually, what a man does will tell you a lot more about what's in his heart. And
sounds like James right now.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's true. The way that what you do matters, and it reflects what's actually inside. And so when you see this kind of man living that kind of life, that kind of corrupt life, and you have to take that into account when you're judging his ideas.
Yes.
Sure. Not to say, but that doesn't mean that his ideas are necessarily wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you want an actionable.
But probably. You know, probably his ideas are wrong.
Well, in a sense, we all live inconsistent. I mean, we're all Christians. We all confess Christ as our Savior. And at some point in our lives, we live inconsistently with that.
Yeah.
Right? But there's a difference between that and then, if you truly are saved, you will recognize where you live inconsistently with that and repent. And this was the trajectory of this man's life, and these were his ideas. And he was living out his ideas, and we should see that. That's horrendous, right? Like, oh, yeah, the ideas were correct. Like, when Christians live inconsistently, we're not representing what we believe properly. But with someone like Rousseau, you know, being obstinate, he says obstinate, nasty, paranoid.
We can draw a straight line.
Exactly. To like what he did and his ideas, right?
So yeah. Exactly. Yeah, there are times when somebody does, you're right, live inconsistent with what they believe, what they say, and we can show, like you can show it. You can also show when somebody's actually living consistently with what they believe.
Yeah.
So Rousseau wrote a book called Confessions, which was specifically intended to draw one's mind back to Augustine's Confessions. But instead of what Augustine
sequels
does...
Sequels are never
good. Sequels are never good.
Sequels.
Especially when they're done by Jean-Jacques Rousseau.
That's so good. That's such a good line, talking about Rousseau and Augustine. So with Augustine, you have, you know, the Confessions, which was, in a sense, psychological in a way, right? If you ever read it, it's very focused on like what he's thinking, experiencing what he's going through from a personal perspective. Some people go back to that and think of Confessions as like basically one of the earliest kind of autobiographies, right, where somebody writes in a style about themselves and what's going on. But in Confessions, you see the same tracking that we talked about in the Psalms. It's something that always moves toward God. That's the whole point, right? That he's always moving toward God. It always refocuses on the Lord himself. Rousseau wrote Confessions, and this is what he says. I'm going to read the whole paragraph because I think this is super enlightening. And I think that if you don't yet understand the problem here, that's what we have to get into, right? If you hear this and you don't hear it as a really bad thing, that's what we have to figure out. That's what we need to get you to understand. This is actually bad. So he says, I am resolved on an undertaking that has no model and will have no imitator. I want to show my fellow men a man in all the truth of nature, and this man is to be myself. The particular object of my confessions is to make known my inner self exactly as it was in every circumstance of my life. It is the history of my soul that I promised, and to relate it faithfully, I require no other memorandum. All I need do, as I have done up until now, is to look inside myself. That sounds like a Disney movie.
Which is funny that he says this will have no model, or has this will have no imitator after. He obviously, well,
everybody.
I guess he didn't understand how much of an influence he had.
Just need to look into myself.
This guy has so many TikTok followers.
That's right. He would be crushing.
This guy would be killing.
Crushing the TikTok.
That's the problem.
He really is. Right. He has possessed almost every single modern person.
That's really what TikTok is, though. The majority of TikTok is I'm looking inside myself and presenting it to the world.
Right.
Y'all need to accept me. Everyone needs to accept me.
It's giving yourself a platform, much like a book would have been, right?
Yeah.
So Rousseau looked inside of himself, and we got the French Revolution, we got transgenderism, we got the total societal and family breakdown, right? Think about this. There is a direct line from Rousseau to the French Revolution. Think about the bloodshed, the chaos, the violence involved. I actually think it's helpful to imagine it, right? Imagine how horrific this is, right? Imagine just absolute mob chaos, violence. Some people don't even have to imagine because they've seen some of it now. But that, you just imagine that. That's what was inside of it. You know, imagine Rousseau's children being abandoned by their father, being put in an orphanage and slowly dying, and just imagine what that does to the child, right? Imagine what it's like, not just physically, but just imagine that. Just absolute rejection on the most fundamental human level, and then slowly dying of disease in an overcrowded orphanage. That's what's inside Rousseau. That's what was inside of him. Now, he has all these ideals about how we're actually good and moral and wonderful inside. But no, actually what's inside of him is this. And so the question is, what's inside of you?
If you do the same thing as Rousseau, what will come out?
Yeah, what's going to come out? I can tell you it's not going to be good.
Yeah.
And his response to that is very Michael Scottian. And it's, well, if I did something wrong, it's the culture that made me this way.
Where he really touches on that, how... Right, because that was the whole Rousseauian idea, that it was society that makes us corrupt.
Inauthentic. Right?
Which is interesting to me, because what is society made up of? Individuals. Individuals need to go out and be authentic, but society makes them corrupt. Society is made up of individuals, right? I think you want to know what's in man. Get a bunch of them together and then like see what ideas they come up with.
See what ideas they have. See what they build.
Yeah, see what they build. I think that's a good indication. Not like this separation of like, oh, then they'll be pure once they're separate from all society and like go out and like go into nature. It's like, well, I think a pretty good indication is to get them all together and, like you said, see what happens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't know. I just think about that.
This leads into, you know, maybe these ideas of authenticity, what it looks like. This, you know, this is where, you know, Truman says the idea of expressive individualism really comes from. Is this idea that you have to, in order to be authentic and true, you have to live out those inner desires and feelings that you have. And then everybody else has to, in some way or another, accept that.
Yeah.
Right? He says this is the idea that the genuine person is the one who acts outwardly in a manner consistent with how they think or feel inside. That's what expressive individualism is.
Yeah.
So
it's like to be able to stand in the
when you talk about significance, right? Yeah. Like, for instance, if God does the permanent work in his heart, then he actually gets reestablished. Like, what will happen
for him?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that would be
your average.
Yeah, you've done. That's what,
You know, not that you don't do it for yourself, but you do it to be the reflection, because my reflection is also that Christ.
He tells a story from Confessions where Rousseau is talking about just this, kind of defending himself on the basis of society being the corrupting influence as opposed to our own selves and heart being corruptible. And he talks about this situation where he was enticed by a friend, by somebody in need, to steal some asparagus. Which, come on.
If you're going to steal something,
dude,
go for something better.
Dude, really?
You know what your pee is going to smell like in like 3 hours?
So, well, he did sell it, right?
Like,
so
this
fair.
Like,
he
fair.
Stole it to sell. So he, you know, he was convinced by this friend to steal asparagus. And he justified it on the basis of his friend's need. And this is on page 38. Bottom of the first paragraph. It says, Rousseau was not driven by greed or a desire for personal gain. His sin was thus not the result of him being an intrinsically bad person. This is Rousseau's argument, by the way. This isn't Truman saying
that. It's not his commentary on it.
Yep, this is Rousseau's argument. It says, on the contrary, it speaks to an extent of his sympathy for another in need. Second, he mentions that he was also lured into committing a crime by Verrat, flattering him as a talented young man. It was the fact that he liked to be liked, not that he liked doing evil, that proved his undoing. And that movement, right? And maybe you didn't even catch it. It's easy to miss that movement. But there is a significant difference there between I did this thing that's wrong because there is something wrong about me versus I did this thing that is wrong. But actually, in a way, it was right, and it's not my fault. Right?
My heart was in the right place.
My heart was in the right place. But what I was doing actually wasn't that bad. So it gives you sympathy for the person that's actually the villain in this circumstance, right?
Yeah.
Right. In this circumstance, you have done something wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But you're creating this situation. You're speaking of the situation in such a way that it actually frames it as though I was actually a good person. I was doing the right, or I was taking advantage of.
Yeah.
And that's it.
Well, I think that I immediately go to thinking about Nashville shooting that happened. Was that last year or a couple years ago?
Yeah, within the last year.
Yeah, within the last year, where it's like this. That girl who thinks she's a man. She thought she was a man. Goes in and shoots up a school. And what does the media do? Well, she shoots up a Christian school. And what does the media immediately do? Oh, the transgender community is under attack. Oh, they're in danger, right? I forget how many were killed, but they added her as a victim to like the number of people. Like, oh, there's actually 7 victims, not 6 or whatever the number was. And it was just all of society, like her Christian like legalistic Christian upbringing or whatever it was, this society, like this pressure of like, you know,
it must have been something
Christian
else. She can't be her.
No,
right.
She wasn't
it had
evil.
To have been something
yeah.
from society forcing her to do
exactly.
It's
yeah.
so evil.
Yeah,
it's so evil.
It is.
Yeah.
It's and that's exactly what he did here. It's the it's a modern day example of what Rousseau is arguing for here. That I was actually a victim of this, even though I'm the one that stole something.
Mm-hmm.
I could just said no, right? But I didn't, and I stole something. I'm actually a victim.
Mm-hmm.
You should really realize that this society, this rot,
mm-hmm.
symbolizes, you know, in this situation is the societal pressure. Like that's the problem, not me, not what I did. So yeah, and unfortunately, again, straight line, right? To
straight line. Well, yeah. So he brings up even later the way that this shows forth, and you've seen it, I'm sure,
yeah.
in the criminal justice system today.
Yeah.
And now so much
is,
you know, so many times, you know, judges or others will weight, you know, somebody's environmental upbringing or the environmental factors leading to somebody causing, you know, committing a crime. Rather than saying, hey, you did this thing, you objectively did it, which means that you need to have this kind of objective punishment of some kind. Instead, everything is, well, you did this. Well, why? Why did you do this? Let's paint a sympathetic picture. Oh, well, you had a tough upbringing and life was hard. And that might be true.
Yes.
You still did something evil, right? Like, you still did something evil. You should be punished. And the moment that you make that shift, you know, you think about even the way that Scripture speaks of the role of civil authorities, the primary role of civil authorities is the issue of justice, right? It's carrying out justice. It's being a terror to the evildoers. It is, right, it's bearing the sword against evildoers. So there's a significant element of, you know, what we would call criminal justice, those sorts of things, that the civil authority has.
Yeah.
The moment that you change that from a, you know, a law, objective standard, you did this, you received this punishment, done, right? There's no other, you know, we're not going to adjudicate a lot of other, like your internal feelings about it and what you thought you were doing. It's just based on what happened, what you did. The moment that you change to that more sympathetic view, hey, we need to figure out what led you to do this. What was it that caused that? What all of a sudden happens is you get away from just dispensing some kind of punishment to total social engineering.
Yeah.
Oh, what caused this? Well, it was, you know, you grew up in a low-income environment. You grew up in a, you know, without much education.
Yeah. I mean, let me know.
You grew up whatever. And now all of a sudden, that force that should have just been administering justice steps in and starts saying, well, now we need to step in and be in control of everything that happens to somebody. That's the only way to actually do criminal justice, right? But it just, everything then becomes, you've got to be a part of it. You got to be involved in it, in somebody's life, because it's the only way to keep this from happening. Because it's the social situation that causes it. It's causal.
No, I can.
And that's something I challenge myself.
I can testify firsthand that that is.
You should desire.
I've witnessed that multiple times. You know, working in the, you know, working in the court, doing court security, sitting through plenty of hearings, sentencing hearings, and all that stuff. So many times it was like, well, you know, the argument, like the defense attorney would try to argue from that point of like, well, you know, they grew up, you know, they didn't have a father, like they witnessed sexual abuse when they were younger and all that stuff. That's why they're doing this. And again, it's like you said, they're practicing this type of social engineering or like sociology instead of administering justice, instead of objectively, you know, carrying out what the law is and what the law requires, the penalty the law requires. And you know what it does is it just enables the cycle to keep going, keep getting worse, and keep getting worse. But again, that was like the common joke, but it's like, well, there's like people aren't bad, they just do bad things.
So we're
going to
meet tomorrow.
Yeah.
Okay. I thought it would be.
You weren't a bad person. You just did a bad thing.
It's also why Hollywood is so bad at making good villains today.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly.
Because there are no bad guys.
And if they do make a good villain, then they have to go back and show. Oh, actually, this is why they.
Here's how Darth Vader became Darth Vader.
Exactly.
Yeah.
This is how you know.
Yeah.
This is why Thanos.
Come to really like him, and now.
Yeah. Now you understand.
Make him sympathetic.
How
on this on page 39, he has a longer quote from Rousseau, and I don't have to read the whole thing. If you have the book, highly recommend read through it. But this is what I imagine. I'll just read the first part of the paragraph. But this is basically Rousseau saying, you know, if only we were able to live out the ideals in our heart, then
it would be Edenic.
Then right, everything would be perfect and everything like that. I just imagine. Listen to this and. And, like, just imagine the degradation of society. Imagine how, like, ugly and horrible and violent and nasty everything's become. Just imagine those things as you hear what he says. Right? And I actually think this would be really cool if somebody took this and they would just, like, read this and then just put pictures of just the, like, gross, ugly side of society to them. Right? But how sweet it would be, he says, to live among us if the outward countenance were always the image of the heart's dispositions, if decency were virtue, if our maxims were our rules, if genuine philosophy were inseparable from the title of philosopher, before art had fashioned our manners and taught our passions to speak in ready-made terms, our morals were rustic but natural, and differences in conduct conveyed differences of character at first glance. And he has this idea of, like, well, everybody is themselves, right? They're not all conformed to some other standard. And then, at the same time, everything is beautiful and perfect and wonderful and Edenic, right?
Did he ever think that the guy who enticed him to steal asparagus was living out the image of his heart's disposition?
Right.
Right.
Yeah,
you said, like,
just think about how.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just think about how ugly and disturbing and violent and perverted and just broken everything is.
No, that's okay.
And imagine Rousseau saying that in the midst of the, you know.
Or picture his son in the orphanage reading this.
Yep.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, son the
daughter. How sweet this would be if everybody acted like my dad did.
Yep. Yeah.
Right. Yep. Exactly. Yeah, except they literally probably did not get any chance to read or to learn how to read or anything, right? Yeah. Like there, because their father took that away from them. Because he was corrupt and wicked. And actually,
no, because he was practicing harsh dispositions. Come on, Michael. Because he was living out his true self.
Pool tax.
Oh, it's brutal.
It is.
I'll tell Tracy about it, but we should get together.
It really is.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Let me know when you guys
are available on the.
I thought on 41, Truman had an interesting thought there. First full paragraph there, he writes, if the original pristine individual is the truly authentic me, then not just institutions, but every other person stands in a naturally adversarial relationship to me.
Yeah.
Everyone else is first and foremost a potential threat to my authenticity.
Yeah.
And that comes out in violence.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yes.
And that's why we see it.
At least in violence,
yeah.
I mean, you think about, like, those who are most gone, most deeply down the rabbit hole of narcissism, right? Where they're turning inward.
Yep.
All they can think about is themselves. They can't interact with others. They can only, you know, they can only interact with others through the lens of themselves, right?
Right.
Completely turned in.
Yep.
Who is that? What's, like, that's mass shooters,
mm-hmm.
right? You read the guys from Columbine or others, right? You read some of this stuff. That's, like, that's actually what this is. You're right. It leads to violence. And it doesn't always come out in physical violence because, by the way, the common grace of God and his continued restraint of evil.
Yeah.
He doesn't allow everybody to get to that point. He could, right? Like, he may just let go and everyone becomes more and more violent. And we are seeing that.
Yeah.
We are seeing an increasing violence between peoples, right? Mm-hmm. You think about situations where, like, what kind of a society could it be where, like, somebody gets cut off in traffic and that makes them so upset that they get out and they beat somebody to a pulp or they shoot them?
Yeah.
That happens not irregularly, not like it's every day. I mean, I don't, you know, it's not happening around here much, right?
Right.
But it happened. The fact that it happens at all should tell you, okay, something's up.
Yeah.
You know, something's going on. But you're right, like that, as people are more and more atomized, and then because you simply can't live with anyone else and not come into conflict with that inner personal what I want, right? What I desire, who I am, that authenticity does clash, and it clashes more where there's less and less general conformity, right? It clashes more when it's like, well, all of us are doing this. And so it does create a situation where you at least have to continually cut yourself off from others, become alienated, disassociate from others. C.S. Lewis in The Great Divorce talks about hell, when he's speaking about what hell is like, it's like a place where, you know, people arrive on this, you know, bus to hell, they show up in hell, and they're initially they're all in this town together. But then slowly what happens is inevitably they become angry, violent, bitter toward one another, and so they move out away from everyone else. But everywhere they go, they find others that they can't, you know, they can't get along with, they can't, that they hate. And so as they continue to find that, they continue to move out further and further and further. And that just, you know, he describes this as a process that goes on forever as people move out into outer darkness, further and further away from anyone else. That I think that that's actually a very accurate depiction of the nature of this kind of degradation.
Yeah, right after that, he quotes Rousseau. I think this is more of like a famous quote from him, but man is born free, yet everywhere he's in chains. And Carl Truman, this is, of course, complete nonsense. Right on, nice. Carl, right on.
Yeah.
Of all creatures on the face of the earth, human beings are born remarkably dependent on others. And that for a remarkably long period of time. Specifically, we are utterly dependent on our parents from birth for some years. No newborn child left alone to its own devices will survive more than a few days at most. One might therefore respond to Rousseau by saying, man is born utterly dependent on others, but everywhere tries to persuade himself that such an obvious fact is not actually true.
Right.
That's a way better quote.
Yeah.
Right? That we are dependent on others. We need others, and yet we continually, again, because, oh, people are a danger or threat to my authentic self, I move away, I push away, I don't engage. I try to convince myself that I don't need other people. Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm.
This leads to romanticism, this very common move where you have a thinker, a preacher, a philosopher, you have somebody crafting and shaping an idea, speaking that in a way into existence, and then what happens is that usually, if that is to gain any traction, it's picked up by creatives. It's picked up by the people that shape and form the social imaginary, which as much as we like to think that we're, you know, logical, thoughtful, rational people, we're not. And so that, you know, what we are actually influenced by, what the social imaginary is built on, is generally entertainment, the arts, these sorts of things. And so just like today, you know, an idea is popularized and really put into people's minds through, you know, TV shows and through, you know, Netflix series and things like that. So in Rousseau's day, his ideas are taken up in the next generation by a lot of these poets and writers, and they take them then and kind of popularize them in people's minds.
Michael, I was kind of curious about your thoughts about, like, kind of, you know, Romanticism had talked about, like, kind of this return to nature, and obviously you being more connected to the earth than most people these days, but you've kind of talked about it before, how, right, there is that sense of people that are, how did you put it before? I'm trying to remember, like, the new agey kind of natural person. It's like, well, they're not Like, they're obviously rejecting God still, but there's something about it. But they're getting that wrong. Like, they're connected to nature of God, which is good because it's God's creation. But obviously, it's fallen. But yet, they're directing their affections
wrong. Yeah. You know, what's interesting is with the Romantics, and you'll see that in some of the quotations that Truman includes. But what the Romantics did was, in a way, you have to realize this is coming in a day when maybe it's increasingly not the case, right? This the earliest parts maybe of some of the Industrial Revolution and movements like that, especially for those who are in, you know, more major cities, metropolitan areas. Especially, you know, you think about the late 1700s, later 1800s. You start to get, especially in a city, you think about like London or somewhere, you know, like Paris or those types of places. These places were dirty places. Yeah. You know, when you think about just the nature of what it took when it came to like, you know, say the just, you know, what it took to cook things and to keep things warm, and you know, as people begin to use coal, and as people like all of these things that are happening in that, you know, stretch of a couple hundred years, you just start to get to be where like it's actually really, it is really crowded and gross and kind of difficult to live in some of these environments. Dealing with some of the like issues of waste management and those sorts of things became really difficult, right? Like that was hard to do in a city. So it made, you know, the waterways and everything are kind of just gross and polluted. And anyway, but other than that, the average person still lived very much in tune and touch with the natural world. That was not abnormal necessarily. And I don't maybe get or probably know enough about the Romantic era to say decisively. I do wonder if some of it was they were kind of moving away from, you know, some of those things, right? Some of the dirtier aspects of the industrial progress that they were experiencing.
Yeah.
But you even notice in the way that they speak of these things is not that they're actually interacting with the natural world. Because you can interact with the natural world by, you know, farming or by, you know, creating something, by, you know, cutting down trees, turning it into lumber, building something with it, by making bricks and building homes. Like, that's all, like, people were doing that across the board. They're very much deep in the natural world. And during this time, they are, you know, by and large, they're in the West, they're Christian and religious people. The Romantics, it seems like they don't as much interact with nature as much as they interact with their feelings about nature.
Yeah.
So they take Rousseau's step, and it's less about, for instance, like you know, beautiful sunset. Like it has this effect on me, which is good and right. Like that's not wrong to like notice those feelings. That like that's actually, you know, objective in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
C.S. Lewis talks about this in The Abolition of Man, that it's not right to write off the sentiments and write off the emotions if they don't matter at all, which is something that did come later with some of the, you know, scientism that came about. No, those things, of course, they matter a ton. What the Romantics did, though, was actually, it was more like those are dictating what I'm seeing and what I'm experiencing.
Yeah, that sunset has worth because of the way it makes me feel.
Because of what it, right. Yeah. It was subjecting the world to one's feelings instead of recognizing one's place. Both, especially as man, as made in the image of God, as made to rule, like we have an interesting place in creation because we are both subject, like we're acted upon by creation.
Yeah.
But at the same time, we've been given a place of dominion where we're made to rule, to reign, to take dominion over it. But that doesn't come by, it doesn't come by denying it on the one hand, like it doesn't matter at all, and it doesn't come on the other hand by saying that, well, whatever I feel and want it to be is what it is. Or like it's here for my you know, internal feeling that I get out of it.
Yeah.
No, that is to subject it it purely to the heart, much like Rousseau does, right? Like it's just a turnaround instead of saying, hey, the society at large is what's acting upon me, and so I'm just, you know, if it was just me, I would be doing way better.
Yeah,
I wouldn't be doing these evil, corrupt things. If I just got to do whatever I wanted out of the pure desire of my heart. Here, it's a little bit more like then taking that next step and saying, actually, yeah, so not only like does society do it, but even the effect of creation of the natural world doesn't matter unless it's,
yeah,
unless it's how I feel about it is right, or yeah, you know, something yeah, like that. It's just, it sentimentalizes it all.
Yeah.
Instead of allowing creation to be something that is objective.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and that at the end of the romantic section there, he talks about, in short, the romantics grants an authority to feelings, to that inner psychological space that all human beings possess. And those feelings are first and foremost genuine, pristine, and true guides of who human beings are. It is only society, with its petty rivalries, its competitiveness, its artificial sophistication, that twists and perverts and distorts those feelings. That is a key move in the path to the modern self, made more compelling by the fact that it is expressed in an artistic form rather than a philosophical argument.
You could maybe say that where, you know, maybe some of the more kind of new age, you know, natural path kind of people, are similar to the romantics is this idea that, well, if I just went out into nature by myself,
yeah,
then everything is right and good and right. Like we could build the perfect little commune out in the jungle, yeah, if we just removed ourselves from all of these societal constraints, where they think that, you know, it's less about how you view the natural order. It's actually much more about you escaping or finding a place where you can fully and completely be yourself.
Yeah.
It's interesting that we, you know, people didn't really find that until actually the internet has actually allowed things like, you know, we talked about TikTok or other places, has actually allowed people in a way that's it's still not fully true. You're still shaped and formed, obviously, by others because you can't get away from that.
Yeah.
But it's, in some ways, I think the closest thing to the ideal that Rousseau or the Romantics maybe would have looked for. Like, you can create your own persona of who you are and completely curate it according to those, you know, internal desires. But even there, you're gonna obviously run into constraints and problems. And,
yeah. Yeah.
It costs money.
Yeah, it costs
you
money.
You have to work.
It costs money.
There's a lot, yeah.
There's thorns and thistles you have to work against.
Right.
Right? That was the whole curse of Adam. You're going to work the ground by the sweat of your brow. So even
actually, Jean-Jacques, my authentic self doesn't work, actually. So my authentic self prefers not to. So if you could just provide for me. Yeah, he makes a compelling argument for why we ought to study these philosophers. I enjoy his little analogy on 47. Fish swim in water. They don't give it a second thought. But the scientist who analyzes the water is far more informed about the aquatic environment. Thus, looking at Rousseau and the Romantics allows us to see the significance and the tacit assumptions of the culture in which we live. That just gives, again, just a good backdrop for why it's worth looking at the ideas of these men who lived, you know, multiple centuries ago to see the influence they've had on the culture and the foundation it's built off of. And, as we said earlier, what it leads to inevitably.
Yep, he kind of ends just talking about how this is just brought us to a total cultural relativism.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there is no objective standard. Everybody can do as they wish. Everybody does what's right in their own eyes. And that's a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
Like that's where we're at. Nobody should have the right to judge or object to any way of life that anybody else has.
Yeah.
Now, there's still, even in our day, you know, there are people try to put limits on that. Those limits are consistently being attacked, like, and removed.
Yeah.
But there's always something, because people realize that you can't 100% drive the car without brakes. There's got to be some kind of brake.
Exactly.
Exactly.
There's just debate about what the break is,
yeah,
what it should be, where it should be, and well, whether it should be.
Yeah, you always take these people to that logical conclusion of like, people should just be able to do whatever they want. Oh, so I should be able to, if I feel like killing somebody, oh, no, of course not. It's like, so you do
smart,
understand
right?
There
as
needs
as
to be restraints.
Somebody else.
Don't, well, you're putting restraints on my true, authentic self, right? Like, don't.
That's psychologically harmful.
Yeah,
to me.
Exactly. But so we all do recognize there needs to be restraints because we are interdependent on each other. We do live in community and we can't escape that completely. And the fact that people, you know, they're trying to escape it and be like, oh, I just got to go out with my authentic self. Again, you're going to bump into people, right? If you try to like just add, like you said, atomize society, like sooner or later those atoms are going to bump into each other. There's going to be a reaction,
yep,
as we see, because you can't escape it because there's people all around you. And you really are created to be dependent on other people. God did not create us as self-sustaining units, right? He created us to be in community. And so when this idea of expressive individualism clashes with that, our created order of being interdependent on one another, then unfortunately we get a lot of what we see today.